The ending of our fifth full day and night of practice. I feel really good about the effort that's being made. And want to encourage everyone to stay with this process. It can get confusing. What seems like all these different practices. Focusing on the breath. And spreading the awareness out. Doing sitting, and then walking, qigong, chanting, letting go, big space, patience, can't they just make up their minds? What are we supposed to do? God, maybe they're just confused, you know, they are, it's nice enough. But the path can seem quite confusing. And the Buddha did talk about different dimensions of this path of awakening. You know, sometimes he split it even into eight, you know. Right ways of seeing, what's called right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi, right collectedness. But that can seem, you know, really complex. So sometimes the Buddha would talk about the path in three ways. He'd say, well, no, there's this practicing, overseeing your action in the world and learning to be ethical, not to harm, not to exploit. That's one dimension. And another dimension is the meditation, learning to cultivate composure, stability, learning to be at ease and plugged in, rooted in being here and now. That then gives rise to this third liberating wisdom. Sometimes the path is talked about three, but, you know, that seems a bit complicated too. And then, you know, if that's too contemplated, what it all goes to and what links all these different dimensions is the training of awareness. When the Buddha was asked, what do you teach? He sometimes said, I teach suffering and the ending of suffering. And what leads to suffering? This experience of stress, conflict, instability. As Tanishra pointed out in her talk, quoting the Buddha, avicca, avidya paccaya sankhara. The condition that gives rise to all the confusion, stress, conflict, the sense of the endless birth and death and never really quite arriving, all of it is avidya, which is not seeing. The image of it is a blindfolded person or a blind person. it's sometimes translated as ignorance. What is the essence of ignoring? It's taking things for granted. It's not that we're all walking around with blindfolds. What are you talking about? I can see. I can hear. But we make assumptions. We can even believe, no, I don't worship any idols. In faiths around the world, there's a, you know, images can cause problems. And we, people think they don't worship idols. Images, things like that. And yet we all worship idols. Bow down to them every day. What idol are you, what's he going on about now? Our views and opinions. Some little thought comes, yes, yes, boss. In the old South Africa, you know, the apartheid system, if, you know, black people had to call their employers boss. You know the word boss? Yes, boss. Even when we came in, the habit is so deeply ingrained when some Zulu people got to know us and they would say, yes, boss, no, boss. I said, please don't call us boss. We're just a friend. And they said, yes, boss. I said, no. You don't have to use that. Okay, boss. But we are a slave to our opinions about ourselves. We can then believe I'm a hopeless case, and then we collapse into a wreck. Because it's true. We believed it. We can believe I'm right and everyone else is a bunch of idiots, and we believe that opinion. The essence of idols, it's bowing down and giving all our power over to this object. Actually, that's much more dangerous idol, the views and opinions, than an image. If we know an image is just a symbol. I've been into, have good friends that are Christians, and they're, you know, sometimes going on at me about the, you know, the idol, that Buddha is an idol. There it is. And I said, oh, you don't have any symbols. No, we don't fool that. I said, what's that cross doing up there? Oh, it's a symbol. Is all the power in the cross? It's a symbol, reminding one that if we stay with suffering, there's a possibility of having a transformation to resurrection. A new life can happen if one stays with suffering. That's the noble truth. Ignorance is this. We're cultivating different ways of helping shed light on our views, our opinions. And when one understands a symbol, one can have it or not have it. I mean, I like Buddha images, but it's just it's a symbol. You can have it, you cannot have it. Some people think, I don't have any faith. To be a Buddhist or to practice like this, you got to have faith. I don't have any. I say, huh? No, sorry. I said, well, did you have a faith in that opinion? You just don't have faith? Didn't you just believe that opinion about yourself? I don't have faith. In the practice of awareness, we're honoring every moment, like that child, to look freshly and our views, our opinions, our feelings. It all sounds like different stuff. Oh my God, the body and standing and sitting and chanting, and it's all coming down to shining the light of awareness, of noticing, which allows us to know something as it is, not just taking someone else's opinion. When we use this mindfulness, this awareness, this presence, that's a naked, intimate, direct touching of experience and seeing for ourselves. But it can get very, very, very confusing. A great Hindu sage, Sri Nisargadatta, reduced practice to this simple vision. Wisdom says I'm nothing. Compassion says I'm everything. Between these two banks, the life of the awakened one flows. Wisdom says, I'm nothing. I'm not a thing. A lot of our practice has been about that. First, steadying our capacity to be present, this wisdom factor, this Buddhic factor, of being awake, learning to cultivate it with just being with a sitting, a breath, a step, a walk, a moment. When that capacity is focused on the things that we take to be me, we notice, as we've been doing, that they're changing. We think, I'm a hopeless case, but when we look more closely, that thought, that mood was there, and then in the afternoon, we're ready to save the world. Everything's beautiful. Whoa. Wisdom says I'm no thing. Whatever we notice with our wisdom, we keep seeing it's there and changes and then dissolves. Wisdom ultimately, when we see the suffering, the stress that comes from wanting the body, our energy, our feelings, our health to be steady, when they can't be, because everything, just like in this moment, the light, the sound, the sensations, are a cascading flow of shimmering, shifting phenomena. When we want that to be steady, we get stressed. Wisdom sees that's not who we really are, so it lets go. And we notice the spaciousness, the peace, and things just are what they are. We give everything back. Wisdom says, I'm no thing. Compassion says, I'm everything. We let go, but if we want our emptiness to be empty, we don't want to experience anything, we still suffer. Within this emptiness is everything. Just like within the sky, within empty space, the whole universe appears. We let go and then notice body and feeling as we let go of the boundaries of thinking this is me and mine, as they dissolve, we realize that we're all in this together. There's compassion. Says, I'm everything. Notice they both take us to the same place. When we're contracted around thinking we're this or that, leads to conflict. When we practice letting go, it takes us to this spacious place. Similarly, wisdom takes us to this spacious place. Similarly, when we're pushing things away, when we're practicing kindness, and this is what we're going to move into a little more, emphasizing tomorrow, we're allowing in, not pushing away, including, making peace with, takes us to the same place. But again, it can be confusing. When we're clinging, there's the teaching, let go. But when we're pushing and keeping things at bay, pushing things away, there's the teaching, welcome and embrace. Again, this can be confusing, but it's one mind. One awareness. We're learning to train the awareness to be full. Agile, flexible. But part of us wants it to be mapped out simple. Come on, tell us what to do. Make up your mind. Ajahn Chah says it's like if you're behind some people walking down a road, and if they get too far to the left near the ditch on the left side, out of compassion, he'll shout, hey, go right. Because they're getting in trouble. Go right. But it's like the diligent disciple writes down, Master says, go right. But then when they get too far to the right side and in danger of falling in the ditch on the right side, go left. And the diligent disciple writes down, Master says, go left. I heard it. He said it. I was there. And you can get this big debate. Master says, go left, go right, go left, go right. God, why can't they make up their mind? When there's awareness and there's clinging and stress, we practice letting go to be free. That's the wisdom, tasting the underlying stillness. It's like in the night sky in Africa when the lightning is flashing and you want to catch it. It's so exciting, but you can't ever catch up with it. It's exciting. But when one lets the lightning flashes just be what they are, uncatchable, you can notice the unmoving, deep, black, luminous, boundless sky, which is undisturbed. It's still. And then the lightning flashes, one can appreciate it. But you know, they're not catchable. You're letting go. And then that dimension that we didn't notice becomes apparent. It's not we created the sky, we just noticed the peace. When we're trying to catch pleasure and certainty and get it right, and it's all wonderful, but sometimes it's like the Buddha said, our experience is like lightning. We're trying to catch it. When we start noticing change, it's like noticing the lightning. When we realize how uncatchable it is, we practice letting it be, and then it's still changing, but just like noticing that deep sky, when we let be, allow change to be conscious, we touch into that sky-like, spacious, silent, luminous awareness that is here all the time that we haven't noticed when we're so busy getting something and getting rid of something. Let go. Is the appropriate medicine sometimes. It's still about awareness, but the awareness that's learning how to hold lightly. But we taste that peace. It was incredible. It was a Thursday. It was afternoon. It was amazing. Yeah. Then we're practicing again, and there's the back pain, and then that obsessive mind, and you know. But and we remember that peace. Oh wow, and we're pushing the back pain away, and pushing all those obsessive thoughts away, and you know, the peace. Compassion says I'm everything. And what happens if we, instead of just try to get rid of, we think we're letting go, but we're just pushing it away. It's not letting go. It's called aversion. Disguised as letting go. But when we practice welcoming, embracing, that takes us back again in time to that sky-like, spacious, easeful abiding. The emptiness, as it is said, is not empty. True emptiness has within it form, but the form, you can't say it's existing. If you try to keep something, it goes and changes and we get stressed. So the emptiness isn't empty, the existence doesn't exist. However you try to say it is impossible. As our Chinese master said, when you see a bubble on a river, you can say, see, there it is. It's beautiful. Look at the colors. Wow, that's amazing. Bubbles are amazing. They are. And then pop. And someone else comes in. Yeah. That person thinks they exist. They are empty. They don't exist. They're insubstantial. There it is again. No, there it is. A bubble is pop. It isn't. Is, isn't, is, isn't, is, isn't. Is it left? Is it right? Is it letting go? Is it embracing? Is it empty? Is it full? One of my favorite expressions of the Buddha is from the Lotus Sutra in the Mahayana text, when the Buddha says, this Dharma, this cosmos, that's what Dharma means, this universe with consciousness in it. He said, this Dharma cannot be described. Words fall silent before it. Excuse me, Kitty Sorrow, but I don't want to be disrespectful, but you sure are saying quite a few words. They're pointers, but one of the most important gifts on this retreat that we would like to offer is to, we use words as pointers, but when we turn to words and our views and these idols that we bow down to, we might not think we have faith, but we have faith all the time in our worries, our doubts, our prejudices. Is that the words, the opinions are approximations. the is, the isn't. We can use them to come back into balance. So we're training one awareness to focus, to see change, to also let go, and then to embrace. And this takes a lot of this embracing, this kindness, this patience is big. Because we can be in a big hurry. I wasn't into the embracing kindness bit. I wanted universe-shattering emptiness and being gone. I was in a big hurry to be finished. And I had some, a few kind of modest insights, which I thought were something, early on in my monastic life, and then I just thought it was all going too slow. And so I wanted to do extra practices. So it wasn't enough just to do the regular practice. We were getting up at, I think, 3:30 in the morning and all night sitting, like I said, once a week. But I had to do extra practices. So I for 3 months didn't lie down. Extra tough practice. And then one that wasn't even recommended, I just threw in there. Fasting. Then I threw another one in there, doing extra service to the abbot. Because we had a different abbot, not Ajahn Chah, but a different abbot, a Western abbot, who I was encouraging him. He was new at being an abbot and massaging his feet. And then I thought, oh, these Westerners just talk too much. So at a certain point, I wanted to go to a tougher monastery where the abbot had a reputation of being really tough. He was like the super duper drill sergeant of tough monk, Thai monks. Meanwhile, I had had diarrhea for 6 months already, but I thought, don't worry about that. And then I noticed that even though I'd had some breakthroughs in peacefulness, that I still just would, I was talking about taking wisdom around eating, when the one meal a day would come, I would just lose it. No, I would. And then, especially in this drill sergeant, he's so sweet and wonderful. He used to be a nightclub singer, kind of malam. He had tattoos all over him, even in private places, I am told. Though I can't vouch for the private ones. But, and gold teeth, when he smiled, the room would light up. But he got inspired by Ajahn Chah. And in Thailand, it's such a chui culture. Anybody who knows Thai, that means laid back and making things sunuk mai. Is it comfy? Making everything nice is really, they're experts at that in Thailand. And so, to be a drill sergeant for the Thais is wonderful because it lights a fire under them. But you do that to Westerners and you got trouble because we're already neurotic and... But anyway, this guy had, sweet dear Ajahn Jung, he decided that the Thais were just taking entirely too much time eating and enjoying it way too much. So he initiated time limits. And they had just gotten electricity. And so usually in the time, in Ajahn Chah's monastery, it's a long affair and it's very formal. And the first monk takes the first bite, but you're pretending you're not noticing. and you're all sitting in a line, and if the etiquette is you don't start eating till the one senior to you takes the first bite. So you're waiting for the next one, waiting for the next one, but you're not pretending not to notice. But you haven't eaten for 24 hours, and so you're kind of, and all your desires are focused on this bowl. So that's, you know, an Ajahn Chah, and because the Buddha never said anything about time limits on. But anyway, Ajahn Chah was creative. So he just got an electricity, and so he decided, and he had a buzzer. Somebody gave him a buzzer. And so he would hit that thing, and it would go, bah! And so then you knew that you had limited time. And you're talking about you don't get to eat for 24 hours. And these guys in the monastery had it down. I mean, you know, I was used to eating with one hand. But, you know, if you're eating just with one hand, you're just not going to, you're not going to get there. So I was doing. And you learn to scan the bowl because what you can, you know, and I must admit, the sweets that they had there were incredible. And so, you know, I would just be, I learned how to inhale. This is not a Buddhist practice, but this is what happened. So it wasn't long. And then once the buzzer hits again, bah, you're supposed to stop. Now, if you can keep eating, but it's like putting a big sign up, flashing sign around you saying, I am a greedy monk. I am a greedy monk. So. And then always after the meal, I feel like a beached whale. And I say never again, never again. And then every time, you know, getting knocked over. And then my mind was just, you know, as a monk, you're just one meal a day and it's celibate, no acting on sexual impulses. And, you know, my mind's just, you know, kind of filled with lust. And, you know, I just thinking, oh my goodness, what's happening to me? And then, so the diarrhea, then I got bit by a centipede and ended up urinating blood. And then, at a certain point, I really started getting, it felt hopeless, very depressed. And, you know, I had been a champion and I was a champion wrestler. I was used to winning things and, you know, being good at things. And I'd had some insights, and so I figured out, you know, if I had insights quick, you know, you just add it up, you're going to get there. Even a 10-day retreat, you know, okay, it was tough, but day three you had this, and then, you know, three 10-day periods in a month, and, you know, you're going to just, how long is it going to be? You crack it. But at some point, I remember just sitting in the line and, you know, wanting to be good, but just feeling greedy, lustful, useless. And you'd look up the line and it's just a row of bald-headed monks. You look down the line. Another row, bald-headed monks. And you look inside, and it's just, you know, crazy. And I thought I was getting fat. I had lost loads of pounds, but, you know, I think I was anorexic. I don't know, but I was a big belly. So I just really started thinking this is, and so I really thought I couldn't imagine laughing again. It felt so impossible. So I thought, this is the time I need to go see Ajahn Chah. So I wasn't with my beloved. Actually, the drill sergeant monk was very sweet. When I got bit by the centipede and was urinating blood, he thought I might end up dying in the monastery, and that wouldn't have been good, and he was worried about me. And so he sent me to a hospital, which was also a bit of a nightmare. But I ended back up in the Western monastery, and when I got really depressed, And then the abbot, who could speak fluent Laotian and Thai, he was Ajahn Pabakaro. He was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and then in that war, and then when he finally got disillusioned with war, and ended up as a really fine monk. And so he then offered to take me over to talk to Ajahn Chah. And so everyone went to the evening chanting, and Ajahn Chah knew this foreigner was going to come and talk to him. He knew me. He had ordained me. And so he's sitting under his hut in his chair. And so we come to Ajahn Chah. And he said, Bin Young. You know, he said, well, what is it? And I said, Lungpa, I don't. It feels like I'm never going to laugh again. You know, I'm just, you know, greedy and lustful, and, you know, my mind's a mess. And he said, And he asked me to talk some about my life. And then, you know, so he heard about me being a champion wrestler and being good at academics, and he was really good at knowing human nature. He listened. And then he said, you know, Kittisaro, you remind me of a baby squirrel. Do y'all have squirrels here? Chipmunks? They're things that climb trees. They're little things. And so Pabakaro whispers, he says, you remind him of a baby chipmunk. I said, okay. They have four legs, big long furry tail. They climb tree. Yeah. And so he's telling the story, and he said, well, this little baby saw its mother run up the tree, jump from branch to branch, do all these acrobatics up there, and the baby thought, wow, that's neat. I'm a coming. And so the little baby went up and jumped and fell down. Dok. The word in Thai is dok. And it means fell down. So the baby chipmunk or squirrel just started crying. And the mother said, son, you just need to go to kindergarten. And so the baby chipmunk starts school, learns a few tricks, and then dok. And cries again, and the mom says, oh, you know, you just got keep going to school. So anyway, Ajahn Chah is going through this and has this chipmunk going to school, first grade, second grade, third grade, and then dok, it falls down, it's crying. And so Pabakaro's whispering in my ear about all this. And at some point, you know, and each time it cried, it's almost like Ajahn Chah's eyes, you know, went around in circles. And he's just smiling. But at some point in college, you know, he had this chipmunk going to college. I started getting hysterical laughter. I was on his floor laughing. And meanwhile, Ajahn Chah keeps talking, and he's got this chipmunk getting a PhD. He's got this thing getting a PhD. And then finally, I'm laughing so hard, and I'm getting up, and he's still talking, and this chipmunk's got this PhD. And then he looks at me right in the eyes, and he said, and one day, that chipmunk could do every single thing its mother could do. Just looked at me like that. And this glow of well-being. And somehow, you know, he just got me to just see all our failings and beginning again, failing, just light, you know, just let it be, keep going, we can do it. And I was basking in that. And I used to actually stop telling this until Tanisra just said, hey, you can't just leave that out. Cause he jumped right ahead and said, you know, you also remind me of a donkey. And I blotted that out for like 10 years. until Tanisra told me, hey, that's an important story, Kitizaro. So anyway, Babakro says, he says you remind him of a donkey. And I'm thinking, whoa, wait a minute. I'm quite happy with this chipmunk story. So, okay, this donkey. Okay, what's going on with the donkey? And so Ajahn Chah says, no, this is an unusual donkey. And I'm feeling a bit better. This donkey appreciates music. It's listening to the cicadas in the forest, the insects making all this music. The sound in the forest, it's amazing sound. And so this donkey being a clever donkey, I can relate to that. A clever donkey says, I'm going to do some research. And so it starts studying what the insects do and how they are nourished. Because this donkey wanted to make music. And it noticed these cicadas, these crickets or whatever they were, licked dewdrops. The dew. The moisture in the morning. And so the donkey studied this quite thoroughly. And saw that. And so it then knew what it had to do. And so being diligent, hardworking, this donkey licked not 10, not hundreds, hundreds upon hundreds of dewdrops. And then was ready to make music. And then it got really disappointed. And that was the end of the story. I'm thinking, wait a minute. And so the two together, just as you know, that first story, with confidence he could tell me one day you could do everything the chipmunk that its mother could do, because this is our nature. The Buddha said something similar. That even when you do your first nodding to the Buddha, your first movement into the path, your first noticing of change, you set in motion the karma of shining the light of awareness onto something, and that will reveal the true empty nature. The Buddha said, you know, don't have any further doubts, you will attain full awakening. We just need to keep practicing. It's our nature. And, you know, so to me that story was about just holding our failures lightly, continuing, practicing. And this donkey story, which I blotted out for quite a while, I'm still digesting the donkey story. But I think it's something to do with it's not a question of making ourselves into somebody else. The transformation happens with this body, this nature, this being. And we're listening into our sound rather than just wanting somebody else's sound, somebody else's this. That the flowering happens through this being. And this is where this kindness that we'll be looking at. There's letting go, but also there's embracing our tendencies. All the discouragement, all the different self-aversion, which we have a lot of in this culture too, I notice. And rather than believing it, learning to, as I said at the beginning of this talk, listen to how we invest so much importance in thoughts. We learn to let them keep bubbling and seeing that ultimately we can't capture who we are with a thought. But this kind and patient willingness to just be with this reading the book of the heart that Ajahn Chah called it, this being with our nature, whatever the patterns are, being with our body, our sound, and then out of that finding our sound, the sound that comes out of our honest and kind and patient being with things. It's not a question of trying to make ourselves into something else. The magic happens by shining the light of kind and wise awareness into this body, this mind, this moment. So, we don't have magic wands. We can just pass on some of what our teachers have encouraged us with and some of our own experience. But to really encourage you all to be really patient, really kind, and to stay with this process of cultivating awareness, cultivating presence. And just like Ajahn Chah said, what he said to me, he's saying to all of us, you can do it. You fall down, keep practicing. Fall down, begin again. And have the kindness to work with our body, our mind, our stuff. And allow the miracle of transformation, the miracle of the Dharma, to work in its own way. So thank you for your patience this evening, for all of your good practice today. And finishing by just letting everything go into the silence for a minute. All living beings suffer. We're all brothers and sisters in this mysterious, seamless totality, deeply interconnected. So at the ending of this day, can we relax and allow our good fortune to be shared with our Dharma body, with all our fellow kindred spirits. May all beings receive the blessings of our practice as we breathe out and relax, above, below, and all around. May all beings experience freedom from suffering.